Not much, just sitting here in the podcast zone.
We're both in the P-Zone.
We are in the P-Zone.
You know what that means? When two Reichards,
yes,
you and me specifically, join forces in the P-Zone, that means that a podcast is about to be recorded.
It's true. That's when the streams get panned.
It's like all the Dragon Balls coming together and then Shenron emerges.
Exactly.
It's like the two Reichards in the P-Zone and then you get a podcast, which isn't as good as everyone who's ever died being revived, but...
No.
You know,
on the scale of importance, on a worldwide scale, we're pretty low compared to that.
Yeah, that whole Shenron thing was kind of like game-breaking. I mean, like, why not just employ him all the time? Before I actually watched Dragon Ball Z, I thought that the Dragon Balls played a much bigger role in the story, but it was actually just like they would just come in at the very end when the situation seemed completely helpless. It was like, what was it, like Deus Ex Machina?
It's a very convenient plot device that, like, if they want to just retcon something and be like, oh, they're not dead now,
right,
they can just do that all the time.
Right.
The show does a lot of Infinity Plus One stuff where it's just like, oh, here's the ultimate ruler of the world and the universe. And it's like, oh, but then this guy was above him. And then, oh, this thing's more powerful, actually. But then if he goes to this superpower level... Then...
Within the first few episodes, Piccolo was making the moon explode. Like, how... And you...
Was
you...
Piccolo?
I think it was Piccolo.
Oh, yeah, he was. He was super powerful at first. Yeah.
Yeah, and like they went even farther than that. But they started. The starting point was moons exploding.
That's true. And I have not seen Super. And I hear that things get way bigger there. I like the fact that they go full blown crazy escalation. That is kind of fun.
Well, I wish there was more of a build up. I feel like it was so hard so quickly. Whereas, like, you look at My Hero, for instance, mm-hmm, and it's, like, these little incremental improvements are so meaningful because it started from him being such a pipsqueak with no quirk or anything.
Pipsqueak. This is 1982.
I've never said that before.
I've never heard that. What are you?
I wish you didn't draw attention
you
to
classy
it.
Classy Freddie Blassie? What is...
I don't know why. It's so weird how some words are just, like, floating around your head and you never actually say them, and then they just come out and you're like, oh.
Or they're just never even considered for saying. Like, we were watching something recently and somebody said, like, oh, it's the freaking best. And I thought, like, I don't think I've ever said the word freaking.
Yeah, frickin'? Is that what some people say?
Some people say frickin', some people say freaking.
Frickin' is weird.
Yeah.
But freaking is weird.
I think that's probably something people say if they are frequently in circumstances where they can't cuss. If they're around kids and things like that, or they're on TV and, you know, they can't say the actual F word.
Yeah, I think I have said freaking, but I don't think I've ever heard you say it.
I've so rarely had to, in my adult life, be in situations where I can't cuss.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe I haven't honed that skill of mm-hmm not just saying fuck. Because, like, I don't know, when I was a Game Informer, we could beep it. And when I was a Giant Bomb, it was uncensored. And, like, the offices I worked in and stuff, it's not been an issue if mm-hmm people cuss. So, yeah, every once in a while I'll be, like, around a kid or something in the rare instance and I'll say fuck. And I'll be like, oh, wait, you're probably not supposed to say that around kids.
Yeah, cuss is weird. We always said curse.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I remember trying to figure out what the line was with cuss words and curse words.
What is, like, there's a difference?
Well, some people, well, I mean, there's like the official like FCC type stuff where it's like, oh, you can't say, you know, fuck or shit or whatever. But then there's stuff where it's like some people would consider damn a curse word. And some people think shit is. And some people think shit is not that bad. And,
mm-hmm,
you know, it's a whole weird spectrum.
When I was a child, as you know, I have two older brothers.
Correct.
And them and their friends would surround me when I was considerably younger than them and make me say curse words. And I would oblige because it would make them laugh and it would get me attention.
Oh, because you were a small, adorable child with a...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. I remember walking to school in sixth grade and I was like 12. And, you know, nobody was around me. And I remember thinking, like, I'm 12 years old. I'm, you know, I could just cuss right now. And I remember just, like, walking to school and thinking it was so, like, rebellious to by myself on the sidewalk be like, fuck, 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 fuck. It's just, like, a cool kid. I was very popular.
I know you were.
I had a lot of friends and was good at sports and had girlfriends a lot.
Yeah, definitely. I remember one time I was, like, doodling because I used to doodle all the time. I still doodle a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a kid, so... Doodling for me, like writing, like drawing a boob or writing a curse word would be like, oh, this is extreme.
Yeah.
And then either my grandma or my mom found the doodle and got really upset about it.
Yeah.
I remember getting it talking to.
I got sent to the principal's office in first or second grade for drawing Mortal Kombat fatalities. I was in Catholic school, and the nun found my drawing of Raiden blowing up somebody's head and just like red-colored pencil just covering the entire page with blood. And yeah, Catholic school did not like that at all.
Well, if you don't know what Mortal Kombat is, I could see that being concerning if like a kid is just drawing heads exploding.
I should have told them to be like, listen, I'll explain this to you. Come to my uncle's sandwich shop where he's got a Mortal Kombat machine, and I will show you how badass this game is, and you'll totally understand. And Sister Marianne Dice loved Mortal Kombat from that day forward.
Did they employ corporal punishment at your Catholic school?
I saw the occasional ruler across the fingers. I don't remember getting that. I got in trouble a lot back then. It was confusing stuff, like stuff I didn't even do. I wasn't a troublemaker ever. Mm-hmm. I think you probably read the story in one of my books I wrote about how like there was the person that kept throwing wet paper towels over the top of the stalls in the boys' bathroom. Mm-hmm. I did not know this was a scourge on the school. And so I washed my hands, and then I turned around, and Sister Marianne Dice came in to the boys' bathroom and held out her hand and pointed to it and said, "I caught you red-handed, Danny." And I had never heard that phrase before. Uh-huh. And I also did not do anything. I literally peed and then washed my hands. And right. I'm just so confused. And she sent me to the principal's office. And they're sitting around being like, "Well, we know it's been you. We know, you know, for weeks people have been, like, throwing these wet paper towels. We can't be doing that stuff." And I was like, "I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't know this was happening. I didn't do it. I don't know what red-handed means." So,
yeah. Aw, poor little Dan.
I was not a troublemaker.
No.
I was a good kid.
You were washing your hands. I mean, a kid washing their hands.
I was just drawing Mortal Kombat and going to the bathroom. Nothing wrong with that. Mortal Kombat's the best. Yes.
Yes.
Hey.
Hey.
We, I was thinking about segue. I could, Mortal Kombat, and then we did Tekken
last
week.
Oh, wait, let's try to make this a seamless segue.
From Mortal Kombat?
You know what I really like about Mortal Kombat?
What's that?
All those crazy sound effects.
They got great sound effects. And do you remember the Cabal's fatality where he inflates the guy's head and then they float up and they blow up?
Mm-hmm. Oh, that reminds me of a film called Blowout.
Oh, shit, it's Blowout. I was just reading about Blow Up, the movie that it was not really based on.
Blowout, inspired by the 1960s film Blow Up.
Yes, we're really good at segues. We've done 100 of these podcasts.
By Michelangelo Antonioni. I think that's his name.
You're Italian.
But, and then this one's by Brian De Palma. Blowout,
yes.
Starring John Travolta.
Yes.
A great performance by John Travolta.
That is one of the things I want to lead with here, because you and I have a history with John Travolta.
We have a storied history with that man.
Personally, through our Face-Off love, which, you know,
we love Face-Off.
Played at our wedding. We've watched more than any other movie we've ever seen together. And also this podcast. Mm-hmm. We have done Battlefield Earth.
Gotti,
which, you know, two of the absolute worst things we've watched for this podcast. So are those the only two? I don't think we've done more than
Maybe for panning.
For what?
For panning the stream.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot of shit about John Travolta on this podcast. And so I want to give him some credit here.
Well, here's the thing. John Travolta, he's not a great actor nowadays, but he always gives it 1,000,000,000% of effort.
Yes, which is why Face Off is the most I've ever enjoyed him, because that plot is so wacky that it really warrants full wacky Travolta.
Right.
And sometimes full wacky Travolta is just cringy. Like, remember Old Dogs?
Oh, yes.
Or Wild Hogs? That's like, he's going for it, but it's like, this is bad. Mm-hmm. Like, Face Off is good, and he's going for it.
Yeah, I think it helped that he had a template. Like, he had a Nicolas Cage template that he just, you know, built off of.
Just what a perfect stew of elements.
I love that movie.
It's just the best.
But so this performance was apparently fueled by insomnia. John Travolta was suffering from insomnia during the filming of this.
Really?
So that contributed to his kind of like moody, brooding appearance and whatnot. His red eyes at certain
points. He's got some stubble and stuff. And
Yeah. He's young in this. This is early 80s. So.
Yeah, he would have been like 25.
Oh, he was that young.
Yeah, I was looking that up during the movie. Like Lithgow would have been about 35. Mm-hmm. Travolta would have been about like mid to late 20s.
Mm-hmm. And he plays a sound recorder. He's a guy that goes around and records sounds in nature and whatnot to
Jack Terry.
Yeah, to put into B movies, these horror movies that he makes.
Yeah, and like that was one of the things I really loved about this movie, which, by the way, I really, really, really liked this movie.
It was a really good movie.
I'm a big sucker for seeing production stuff in movies. mm-hmm. you know, not necessarily like documentary stuff necessarily, but like just things based around production of films right. and television, things right. like that. Network, you know, we watched Network. We didn't cover that for the podcast. I don't remember if we mentioned it on the podcast, but let's just real quick, Network.
Oh, great movie.
One of the better movies I've seen.
Yes.
Definitely watch that. But yeah, like just through me having produced media for a long time, I love mm-hmm. seeing that stuff presented.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not coming at it from a media production place. Like, obviously, I don't have that experience, but it is really cool to see how the sausage is made. And it's nice when, you know, you see a lot in movies, especially when it comes to things that you and I are familiar with, it those things being dumbed down for mm-hmm. for movies just to make it more palatable for people. But this, it wasn't dumbed down. Not that they were explaining it, but it was they were just showing the process. And it was to see all this kind of analog old school equipment that was used was really interesting to see how that worked, because now, you know, obviously it's much more streamlined and, you know, on a computer and everything, but the analog process is really interesting.
Yeah, it was so cool for me to see the same concepts that you have to do when you're editing, like mm-hmm. shown with this old equipment that
right.
was definitely before my time. Because like I had some time before, like when I was in junior high, I did some tape editing, like on literal tape and stuff on these like Casablanca machines where mm-hmm. you have to turn dials and move the physical, you know, film stuff back and forth. Mm-hmm. But most of my time has been Premiere, Final Cut, that
right.
type of like nonlinear digital editing. So to see the same concepts, like one of my favorite parts is such a minor, stupid thing. And we'll get to what he's editing in a bit, but he's syncing up an audio track with these photos. He's mm-hmm. made like this little flip book of this car crash. And just to see him like marking on the physical tape, like, okay, X for when he hears the shot. And then mm-hmm. he lines that up with the images. And then like S for when the car splashes into the water. And then he lines it up like that concept I've done a million times of syncing audio with video,
mm-hmm.
but I've never seen it with that like physical
right.
film. And like, that was just such a cool thing for me to see.
It was really neat.
Very minor. You know, there's obviously much bigger things going on in this movie, but
yeah.
like, I love that stuff.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, just like the meta aspect of making a movie, making a film within a film.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was cool.
And seeing all the tapes with like just the Sharpie things of like, oh, these are gurgling. This is like glass. This
yeah.
is shots. This
right.
is knives, metal sounds. Like, I don't know. That all just felt really cool, and I wasn't around for that stuff, but like that seemed authentic,
mm-hmm.
you know?
It seems like, I don't know if these kind of professions, I'm sure they exist now, but definitely not in this form. Although I maybe it's not a lofty assumption to say that some people probably still use this kind of equipment, right?
Well, I'm sure there are enthusiasts
yeah.
that like are obsessed with this type of
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah, but it seems like such an interesting kind of like, I don't know, like a lot of like very... I guess like a solo, like a lot of solitude in this kind of job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're just kind of ingratiating yourself in all these different sounds, and the way you, I don't know, the way you perceive the world around you is probably different because you're looking at it like with the sound first rather than what you're seeing. And it's interesting to see that perspective in the movie, because obviously movies are very visual, but I feel like the movie did such a good job of demonstrating like visually what hearing is like, you know what I mean, with the juxtaposition of like him standing there with his recorder and like
mm-hmm.
the owl or like the frog, for instance, whatever. It was really well done.
Yeah, you probably can't turn off, like if you are in that profession, you probably
mm-hmm.
can't turn off that ear. You know, you're always kind of just hearing everything through that filter.
Right.
Like I remember when I was going to game studios a lot with Game Informer, we would interview a lot of sound guys or just
mm-hmm.
like, you know, have casual chats over dinner or drinks with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I can't remember what studio it was. I think it might have been Sucker Punch or something, where this guy was saying like, oh yeah, he was on a train. He was on a trip to Europe or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he always brings his like audio recorder stuff around in case he hears something interesting that he could use for a game or something. And he said he was on this train and like just the sound of like was like super interesting and like
mm-hmm.
very distinct. And so he asked the conductor if he like kind of step out and put his microphone down like close to the tracks and the wheels and everything, and they let him do it. And
that's
he's like
awesome.
Oh, this is something I could put into a game later, this
mm-hmm.
like authentic sound of a train, you know?
Yeah.
Like, so yeah, I don't think you could turn that stuff off, really.
No, it's interesting. It reminds me, I guess to plug another podcast, there's a recent episode of Reply All where like, I guess people
yeah.
sell these like bulk libraries of random stock sounds, and you know, people will resell them as like kind of atmospheric, like
mm-hmm.
sleep sound type of things. And someone was listening to this sleep sound just of an air conditioner running, like that was, and then they heard footsteps in the sound and
yeah.
them sleeping, alone, they thought there was real footsteps in real life, because naturally they didn't expect there to be footsteps in the sleep sound. And then they just took this deep dive trying to find the origins of this sound clip and where it came from and like where it was filmed, what this woman's situation was, because it was the you hear a voice of a woman in the sound clip. But it's really interesting.
Yeah, and it wound up being like the least, like the last thing you would expect, which it was from like Triple X.
Yeah,
like that movie, like it was recording from that somehow wound up into an ambient sleep sound thing.
Yeah, like, but it's interesting, like taking slivers of sounds, it's really like there's so much mystery to it too. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. But so especially in the context of this movie, where it's kind of around this mysterious perhaps assassination of a presidential candidate, I don't really think it ever makes it. Actually, it does kind of blatantly say that it was a assassination, right? At one point, John Lithgow's character,
the plan was, so it is revealed throughout the movie,
right.
That basically they were trying to make it so he wouldn't become president.
Right.
And so I think the plan was they were going to frame him mm-hmm. with pictures of him, you know, cheating on his wife. And then they were going to, like, you know, shoot out his... Because we're basically spoiling the whole movie right here, mm-hmm. but, you know, that's what we do. So basically have someone shoot out his tire while he's driving with this woman, a mistress, and then, like, there would be someone there filming it. And so, like, they would have all this stuff. They would have photos of them in bed together. They would have them, you know, getting pulled out of the same car from the lake and everything. So that was the intention, was right. just to, like, stop this guy from being president. Turns out that the guy that was hired to set the stuff up is pretty much just a sociopath.
Mm-hmm.
Like, John Lithgow, he doesn't really get revealed until, like, halfway through the movie, if not later. He does a quick thing where mm-hmm. he, like, switches the tire out so it doesn't look like it was shot.
Mm-hmm.
But Lithgow, no surprise here, he plays a great menacing weirdo.
Definitely. I mean, have you ever heard of MKUltra?
I heard that phrase.
It's like, it was these experiments that the government did on people, I guess, to try to make people into, like, it was human experimentation. They were also trying to make people into, like, you know, assassin type of people.
Sounds like a Metal Gear or something.
Yeah, I mean, this actually happened, but you don't really know the extent of it, because I guess some, you know, documentation was lost or whatever.
Oh,
but
okay.
Yeah, they abused these people, often very young people. And they would make these like super soldiers that were just desensitized to anything. But yeah, I mean, that was just a total tangent, but John Lithgow's character, it definitely would require a certain degree of, you know, being a sociopath to be able to pull off this stuff. Cause he is assassinating a presidential candidate, and he's also a serial killer.
Yeah, he's kind of going off on his own. He's going into business for himself here, going in and, like, he's like, well, also, what if I started doing a bunch of sex crime murders and that would make it look not weird if we wind up killing that girl?
Right.
It's like, he's doing a lot of stuff that wasn't asked of him.
Right.
And, like, even the people that hired him, like, there's the part where the guy, the political guy's on the phone, he's like, what are you doing, you idiot? And he's like, oh, it's okay. I stabbed them all and I carved Liberty Bells into their chests. And it's like, no one asked you to do that. We just wanted to frame this guy for cheating. So, I feel like Lithgow, he's played that bad guy in a lot of movies, or in Dexter. There's that season of Dexter, and he's just a great, cold, menacing character.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a funny thing, because, like, Lithgow, whenever he's on stuff, like, he used to be on Colbert all the time, on the Colbert Report, and would do hilarious skits with him. He's a very likable, friendly, funny guy, but he always plays these cold, icy killers. But then also Third Rock from the Sun?
Yeah.
But I guess he was supposed to play an alien there that was, like, trying to fit in with humanity, which mm-hmm. I guess in a weird way is kind of similar to, like, these disconnected psychos.
He was very childlike. If I remember correctly, in Third Rock from the Sun, when these aliens came to Earth, the youngest aliens appeared the oldest. So John Lithgow was actually one of the,
right.
like, younger ones. And then, what's his name? Joseph Gordon-Levitt was one of the older ones. But, yeah, he has a range for sure. He's also the narrator for Progresso soup commercials, I noticed.
I didn't know that. Also has a big stage career.
He's really?
A theatrical Broadway type guy. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
I
he's great.
It, yeah.
I like him a lot. So this movie, I feel like it touches on a lot of... Well, first of all, Tarantino used this as the way to convince Miramax to hire John Travolta for Pulp Fiction.
Mm.
Because Travolta had been kind of out of the limelight and his star had dropped quite a bit for a while. And Tarantino, like, had to do some convincing. And he's like, no, look, Travolta can be good.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the best acting I've ever seen Travolta do.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see, like, why Tarantino would love this movie. He says it's one of his three favorite movies of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, it's very referential to, like, older movies. You know, it deals with production and movies themselves. Like, there is a Tarantino quality to this, for sure. Sure. And I feel like it's part, like, political assassination thriller, it's part serial killer story, it's part, like, kind of modern noir, which noir, as a film student, as someone who is sitting somewhere...
An authority on film.
Yes, I, in this room, have a degree that says I'm an authority on film. I hear about film noir a lot. I'm in a game called L.A. Noir. I've heard noir a lot. I don't know how to describe it, but I know it when I see it, and I feel like it's, a lot of it's at night, and there's a lot of cigarettes and mournful saxophones.
I think it's very moody.
Yes.
And there's usually, like, a kind of a mystery that intertwines all the events of the film.
Yeah.
And I think there's, like, it's not really very big and explosive. It's kind of subtle, but there's a lot of tension.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, I know what you mean. I'm sure, you know, if we were to Google it, we could get a clear-cut definition. But, yeah, I know what you mean. It's very moody. It's, you know, it's it has its own flavor, for sure. And atmosphere was a huge part of this this movie. I feel like it was mostly taking place at night.
It was. And, like, I thought the music, like, the whole atmosphere and tone of this was super good. And I also like stories where just, like, a normal person gets wrapped up in a much larger thing out of happenstance.
Right.
It's like I was just in the wrong place at the wrong time. Which, that scene, we were talking about kind of, like, the isolation of being an audio guy. I thought they did, that was one of my favorite scenes. It's when he's just sitting on the bridge, and they really let the scene breathe. And they return to it several times, where it's like, okay, here's the couple that's talking, and he's listening in on their conversation. Here's the owl, here's the frog, here's the crash. Like, it's just so cool. Like, at night, just him just standing on this bridge, just there to get the wind, and then all these other things happen.
Right.
Yeah. And I guess split screen is something that De Palma is very fond of. I haven't seen a lot of De Palma movies.
When you say split screen, is that, like, the two shots right next to each other?
Yeah, yeah. There were several times where they would have, like, full-on just boxes next to each other, and then there was some, like, superimposing, like, the owl's head and things that. I thought that was really cool and added to the feeling of this.
Yeah. Yeah, that it was... There was a lot of moments of, like, isolation.
Totally, yeah. But yeah, it's basically the story of, you know, these people want to ruin this guy's candidacy, and Travolta getting wrapped up in it, and, like, at the hospital. So he pulls the girl, Nancy Allen, plays Sally, a woman, the woman that was basically hired to, like, frame the guy for cheating. And so Travolta, like, you know, good guy in the movie, takes her to the hospital and stuff. And then all of a sudden, like, these people, like, he notices this media frenzy around there. He's like, what the hell's going on here? Because he had no idea, like, this guy was a candidate, you know, and he's basically told, like, hey, forget about the girl, you know, get out of here. Like, not outright threatened, but like, obviously, like, hey, you don't want any part of this. And he goes into full kind of, like, obsession. Like, he starts worrying that he's being too much of a, like, conspiracy theorist, but he also knows he's got the evidence and he just wants to prove it. But it seems like at every turn there's, you know, Lithgow is trying to screw with him and, like, wiretapping him. And meanwhile, like, journalists are starting to kind of get the story and it's on the verge of breaking out, which... That's kind of the interesting thing that, like, throughout this movie, you assume it's going to end with, like, the news thing where he's sitting sitting down in a chair across from Frank Donahue being like, here it is, we're taking him down, here's the footage, and, like, oh, it's on the plastered on every front page. And I think I expected that the whole time. Did you? Yeah, and it doesn't do that.
No.
And I guess we can skip to the end here. But... Basically, well, let's talk about the events leading up to the end. So Lithgow poses as the journalist.
Right.
Trying to get Sally.
Trying to get Sally to give him the film that John Travolta made. And the film was, so the photographer that was on the scene that was there purposefully to be able to frame the guy that got killed.
Yeah, Dennis Franz.
He sold his images to, like, a publication. And it was essentially an image sequence. I mean, it was like an image of every frame that Travolta was able to turn, like, through, you know, turn into a proper animation.
Like a little flipbook, yeah.
Well, yeah, and then he turned it into an actual video that he synced up his audio with.
Right, right.
To make that movie. So, theoretically, like, even though John Lithgow threw that film that he made into the river or whatever, I don't see why John Travolta just couldn't make another one. It would be a pain in the ass, but...
Well, yeah, because he has all the images still. Oh, no. The one he threw in was the straight-up video from Dennis Franz's camera. Because remember, there were two things. There were the still frames that he cut out of the magazine, and he made the flipbook up. But that wasn't clear enough. Remember, it was just a tiny little flash, and it wasn't clear enough. So that's why he had Sally go to Dennis Franz's place. She knocks him out with that bottle, steals the actual videotape, so not the photos. And so that's the one where she goes back to Travolta's place, and they watch it, and it's, like, crystal clear on the tape. So you see the smoke, you see the flash, like, there is no question. So that's the one I think he couldn't replace. basically.
Gotcha.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm a sucker for any kind of like frame by frame type stuff where it's like somebody's looking for something and then you finally have that like, aha, there it is thing. Mm-hmm. And this was very much that.
When Harrison Ford is looking at that image of the girl's snake tattoo.
Yeah, enhance, yeah. And that's cool too because it's got all the cool like future UI stuff. Uh-huh. That, oh, man.
It's a really good movie.
That's a great movie. I loved the ending of this. Like, we'll talk about the specific ending, but like all the lead up where it's set around this like Liberty parade. I don't know. It's some Liberty Bell celebration parade or whatever. And it's a pretty elaborate thing at the end here because like Travolta has Sally wired up when she goes to meet with who he thinks is the reporter. It's actually Lithgow. Lithgow is super about to murder her. And so Travolta misses the train that they take off on. So he has to get in his car and drive through this parade. Like, it's a production. It is like, it is a huge parade, and you've got this car going through it. Like, I was kind of surprised the movie had the budget for such a large kind of set piece.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about it being a noir and, like, the tension that builds. It's most evidenced by the fact that the whole climax of the movie takes place kind of in the last 15 minutes of the movie, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's
totally.
The middle part was rather, not slow, but, you know, it was kind of a slow build, I guess.
Yeah, it's not a whiz-bang action thriller.
No, definitely not. But yeah, it was this elaborate parade that John Travolta just kind of stupidly drives through. I mean, what does he think is going to happen? Yeah,
with some pretty bad green screen while he's in the car. Like, all the shots of the actual car going through look great, but then it cuts to him with, like, some pretty bad green screen. Did you notice that C-3PO was in the parade?
I did not.
I saw it because it's all like very like Uncle Sammy, Liberty type stuff. And then there's C-3PO. And I'm thinking like, what the fuck is C-3PO doing there? And I looked it up. Brian De Palma wrote the scroll at the beginning of the first Star Wars.
Ah.
Like A New Hope, you know, like the yellow text. So De Palma, that was like a little Easter egg there.
Interesting.
Yeah. I never knew that he wrote that. I think I noticed something that they did not explicitly point out in the movie, and I felt very smart, and I felt like the movie was really cool for doing this.
What's that?
Because there's the part, they play the audio so many times of when he's on the bridge, and so, you know, the owl, the frog, all that stuff. But then before the shot, before the actual shot, you hear this like zzz,
oh, right, right.
Several times I remember thinking, like, what is that supposed to be? And they never specifically draw attention to it. But later on, John Lithgow is about to kill a prostitute in a train station. And right beforehand, you see him fiddling with, he's got like this like hitman, like watch wire thing that he strangles people with. And so I think that's what he does before he kills people is he just fiddles with that.
He seems to do it when he's like idle and just.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when I heard that noise, I was like, oh, wait, that was the thing. Right. Like, that was such a fun like realization. I thought that was incredibly
that is cool.
Subtle.
And it's never explicitly said.
No. I love super subtle things like that. One of my favorite parts of the whole movie is, so there's the whole pursuit at the end through the parade and everything, and then Travolta can hear fireworks going off. So he knows he's near like kind of the epicenter of this thing. And there's this giant American flag above the crowds and everything, and that's where Lithgow and Sally start like fighting.
Right.
And like he's on top of her, definitely seems like he's about to like stab her, kill her and everything. Travolta comes up, is able to stop Lithgow, stabs him a ton in the chest with his own like ice pick thing, but Sally's dead. She died. And then he cradles her, and like the shot and the music and the fireworks, like it's like this rotating like shot from underneath, and you see all the fireworks exploding above him while this like music is playing. I thought it was such a cool like moment.
It was cool,
you know. It really really worked.
Yeah.
I thought,
yeah. And the ending obviously was rather solemn and bleak.
Yes. So she dies. I was wondering, because like when he kills Lithgow, you see Sally's neck, and it's not like bleeding profusely, but it's got like the marks on it. And so I was like, oh, okay, is he going to cradle her? And then she, you know, wakes up coughing and stuff. But no, not only is it dark there, but then the ending, why don't you explain that?
You can explain it.
Okay, I'll explain it. So the movie starts with basically they're making this B-movie, and this woman's about to get stabbed in the shower. Yes, they do a really good bad scream for that. But it's very much supposed to be like a Psycho type scene. And like they keep trying to audition these girls throughout the movie to do a better scream.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some really funny parts where the girls are in the booth and they're doing that like terrible scream.
Right.
And it's like no one's ever screamed like this ever.
In their defense, I feel like if I'm screaming from genuine fear, it would sound really good. But if I was asked to scream, I don't think I could do it well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, here. We're going to make it even harder.
Okay.
Because you can't do it as loud as possible because we're in a tiny closet with microphones. So do your scream, but do it softly.
Okay.
Okay. That was better than the ones in the movie. Which, I didn't understand. That was pretty good.
Thank you.
I didn't understand what they were trying to get a scream mm-hmm. that was like, oh no, somebody's about to stab me. And so when they're in the booth, they have like a girl in there just to pull the hair of the other one. It's like, yeah, she's not in the mid-struggle.
Well, if you really want to get a woman to scream, you have to pull their hair. That's like a lever for us.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You like wouldn't get it because you're not a woman.
Oh, okay. Is it like when we flip Razor's Frisbee up and it's like pressing the button that makes him just lose his goddamn mind and yes. gnash it back and forth?
Yes. Whip it around.
So the scream, since he has her wired and he's recording her, he has the actual struggle and her screams mm-hmm. on tape.
Which seems weird. I mean, it seems weird that he would want to use it in a B movie.
Well, I think it's implied that he just was like, he fell into just a real deep, dark place and was obsessing yeah. over it and like listening to it over and over again. And so that's the tragic irony of the ending is he finally has the perfect scream on tape. And so the last scene is they're in the screening room again and it's a really good, authentic sounding scream, and then the producer's like, ah, that's it, we found it, the perfect scream, and Travolta's like, yeah, yeah, like rubbing his temples and, you know, not doing well. So, I don't know, I really loved this. It was not the ending I expected, mm-hmm. and so, like, after it ended, it was kind of like, huh, weird, and then, like, I've definitely liked it more the more I've thought about it. Like, yeah. I kind of had the balls to do that.
Yeah, I can really appreciate when a movie is willing to go there and, you know, not give an ending that will necessarily appeal to audiences.
Well, and it sounds like it was a huge nail in the coffin for this at the box office, because in these pre-internet days, I was reading that, like, terrible word of mouth spread specifically mm-hmm. because it had this really dark ending.
Right.
And people were like, well, I don't want to see that.
Yeah, that's stupid. I feel like the happy ending is so lame. I hate when I'm in the middle of a movie and I'm like, I know they're not going to give us a shitty ending, so I don't really care what's happening here. You know what I mean? It's like the stakes are so low for yeah. a lot of movies. But, you know, I always appreciate when a movie is willing to kind of deviate from that. I mean, it was the same deal with Blade Runner. Blade Runner, like, actually took into consideration the focus testing, unfortunately. And it went through so many different iterations. And the original release had this, like, tacked-on, hacky, stupid, narration ending mm-hmm. that was, like, a happy ending that was so inappropriate. And it was so out of left field.
Oh, so tonally inconsistent with the rest of that movie,
yeah,
for sure.
Where the final cut that was, I think, released in, like, what, 2008 or 2007?
I remember it came out with a big Blu-ray release. In like mid 2000s,
yeah, which was the film as Ridley Scott intended it. It's mm-hmm. so good because it is this kind of like ending where you know that he has an expiration date as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's debate as to whether he's a replicant, but I think, I mean, you see that there's no other explanation in my mind that he's a replicant. But I always appreciate that.
I can't remember. Did 2049, like, since Harrison Ford had aged, did that disprove it? I can't remember.
Not necessarily. They didn't really. It was still kind of ambiguous.
Yeah.
But I remember they didn't really answer it one way or another.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I was trying to think of other movies that I'd seen that, you know, had really dark endings that stuck with me, and one of them is not a great movie, mm-hmm. but I was like 13 when I saw it. But have you ever heard of Mad City?
No.
It was another Travolta movie where he was like a janitor at a museum and he lost his job and he came back with like a shotgun to like threaten his boss and stuff and wound up in this whole crazy hostage situation with kids. But like Travolta is supposed to be a sympathetic bad guy. And he's like, oh, I didn't mean to do all this stuff. Another guy getting wrapped up in mm-hmm. a big thing. And Dustin Hoffman is this reporter who comes in. It's very much about the media making a big circus out of it. And it ends with Travolta with a bunch of like dynamite and strapped to his chest, just blowing himself up. Mm-hmm. And he was supposed to be this like sympathetic character. And Dustin Hoffman is like, we killed him. The media killed him. Mm-hmm. That surprised me. There's another one called Arlington Road where Tim Robbins played this like domestic terrorist and basically tricked Jeff Bridges into like bombing a government facility and framing him for it. Mm. And it was like an incredibly, incredibly dark ending. Like it ends with Jeff Bridges thinking Tim Robbins is driving this van into this government building and he's chasing after him. And then he pulls in and like the security guards are like, no, you're the only unauthorized person here. That van was making a delivery. And then Jeff Bridges looks in the trunk of his own car and the bomb mm-hmm. is in there and mm-hmm. it blows up and Tim Robbins gets what he wants.
Right.
It's like, Jesus, that's super dark.
Yeah. One of my favorite movies, Old Boy, the Korean movie.
Oh, jeez.
I never saw the American remake, but that is a pretty dark ending. I mean, I'm not going to spoil what happens, but it's impossible to talk about without spoiling, but I'm not going to.
Yeah.
Essentially, something terrible happens, and the protagonist, anti-hero protagonist, gets hypnotized to try to forget about it. And the face he makes at the end suggests that he still remembers happened.
I remember you showing that to me, and that movie was, that was surprising, I would say, for sure.
It's a very good movie.
I'd say one of the more famous examples of just a really bleak ending is Seven.
Mm.
What's in the Box, and it's like, yeah, they got the bad guy, but the bad guy got what he wants. Like, he wanted to demonstrate the seven deadly sins and, like, wrath and envy. Like, he basically played out his masterpiece, you know?
Right.
It's like, oh, this is going to be talked about for generations, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Cuckoo's Nest. Cuckoo's Nest had one where Nicholson just gets... spoil every movie, but that's got a sad ending
that
for sure.
Does. A lot of really good movies do.
Yeah.
You know? One I just looked up because I forgot the name of it. Law Abiding Citizen. You never saw that movie, but I think you would like it.
Who's that?
Gerard Butler.
Gamers Gerard Butler?
Yes.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Right. Jamie Foxx. It's about this guy who, like, goes out for revenge after his family is killed, and it's this whole cascading kind of horrible shit happening, and it doesn't really have a good ending.
I love a good revenge movie.
It's a revenge movie for sure.
Is that on a streaming service?
Maybe.
Okay. I'd be curious to keep an eye out.
I think you'd like that movie a lot.
Revenge movies are kind of my thing.
Yeah, well, so. Old boy. Did you see, we watched Lady Vengeance
yep,
together.
That was
did
awesome.
We watch Mr. Vengeance?
We watched the first two of that trilogy. That
okay.
You got
Mr.
That
Vengeance
box set.
Is really good too. Mr. Vengeance is like the one most grounded in reality of those.
Okay.
Of the three in that trilogy, but yeah, it's really good.
Gotcha. Love that stuff. Well, that'll be it for, what did we watch? Blow Up or Out?
Out.
Blow Out.
Out.
It, really, I really, really enjoyed this.
It's a great movie. It was on Amazon Prime, if
yes,
you haven't watched it.
It was on Amazon Prime, so check it out there if you would like to. So as always, we want to extend a special thank you to our patrons on the old Patreon. That is patreon.com/panningthestream. Real simple little thing we do there. You help us out at $5 a month. We will give you an ad-free version of this podcast each and every week. We will send that RSS link right to your email. And then you also get a personalized bonku from Bonk herself.
A bonku?
Yes.
For you.
For you. We read one on the air
yes,
every week, mm-hmm, but you're also going to get it in your email or your Patreon messages
right
away. So,
this one is for our friend Michael. It's actually a person we know personally. I won't
oh,
say
Michael,
his,
Michael.
His last name, but I think we're going to hang out with him pretty soon.
I think so. It's on the calendar, yes.
He's the man with a plan.
He does have plans.
He's got an award-winning smile,
yes,
and what a personality on that guy. Jeez.
Yes.
He's just a great guy. Wrestling brought you two together.
As it brings a lot of people together. Yes. I literally met him in the crowd at WrestleMania.
A sign in particular.
Yes.
yeah, Michael, this one's for you, bud. The alarm was sound. Michael rose from his slumber and answered the call.
Oh, there's some mystery there. That's a noir right there.
That's
a little
right.
Mini noir. Yes. So thank you, Michael, and thank you to everyone on the old Patreon there. Thank you to everyone just listening to our voices each and every week here on Painting the Stream. We love doing this podcast for you, and we're going to keep it moving. So
the choo-choo train.
The old choo-choo
rolling.
Train. We're rolling along from the Pizone. And if you got any comments or suggestions or anything, you can email us at panningthestream@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at panthestream. Find out what we're watching next week and watch along with us if you would like. Thanks to Tom Monda for the theme song.
Thanks, bro.
Thanks to Razor. You're pretty good. Good job, bud.
Quality pooch.
I think you got a treat coming your way. Bonk, thank
yes,
you as always.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you.
For joining me in the Pizone each and every week.
Of course.
We got an official
there's
sign
There's no place
now.
I'd rather be than in the Pizone with you.
It's very official now. We have a big acrylic sign of our logo.
Yes.
Just for us.
It's because, really wonderful.
Yes, I like it a lot. It makes the Pizone seem very official.
Well, we're putting out an official piece of entertainment for people every week, so we need to christen our Pizone with an official Panning the Stream sign.
Absolutely.
Which is what we did.
This is a professional operation we're
because
running.
If someone sneaks into our apartment and they mm-hmm, say this closet, they're not going to think it's a Pizone, but when they
no,
see that sign, they're going to know.
Oh, it's the Pizone, and then they won't disturb the sacred
yeah,
area of the Pizone.
Slowly close the closet door
yep,
and then creep out of the apartment.
They'll write an apology note, leave it there,
yes,
but I didn't know there was a Pizone here.
They'll probably end up leaving a gift for us instead of stealing
yes,
from us.
Absolutely.
It's like the one time my brother snuck into my parents. They have like a little vacation house in Pennsylvania, and he snuck into the house and replaced their old like giant CRTV with a new HDTV. This was probably like 6 years ago or something. And then a week later or something, my mom and dad went to Pennsylvania, and my mom was like so upset that she thought someone broke in. And replaced her old TV with a new fancy TV.
And didn't take anything except
right,
the old worst TV? That is a nice, like, reverse criminal.
Yeah.
That's really funny. All right. That's it for this week.
All right.
Bonk, thank you. Thank you to everyone listening. And we will return next week.
Bye-bye.